You hate yourself and you're 14 and you can be a different person with a different name and a different pronoun and a different body, and nobody will ever be able to refer to the old you. It's a very beguiling, alluring thought, and so these kids fall for it.
As a young girl, Stella O'Malley believed for years that she should have been born a boy.
I would definitely easily have met the criteria that would now be called a diagnosis of childhood onset gender dysphoria. Horrible experience, but I came through it and ultimately became comfortable in my own skin and ultimately became a mother, which is the thing I'm most proud of and most connected to in my life.
Today, she is a practicing psychotherapist and founder of GenSpect, which promotes a non-medicalized approach to gender distress. She is author of many books, including most recently, When Kids Say They're Trans, A Guide for Parents. This is American Thought Leaders, and I'm Yanya Kelek. Stella O'Malley, such a pleasure to have you on American Thought Leaders.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
I'm very happy to have you in that seat. You know, many people I've spoken to that are fighting what we might call gender ideology have spoken of you in a very favorable light. They've mentioned that through GenSpect, your organization, you've provided quite a bit of guidance to them. And, you know, you've written some absolutely fascinating books. When Kids Say They're Trans, yeah, is one. Before we jump into kind of the details, tell me a little bit about your story, which I find actually quite fascinating as well.
Yeah, little did I know I'd be thinking about my childhood so much when I was a fully grown adult. When I was a child, as far back as I could go, so maybe three years old, I thought I should be a boy. And I was very good at being a boy. And I don't remember what was the thought process of me as a three-year-old that came to that conclusion, but I was very assertive. And I was very consistent, persistent, and insistent, which is the kind of criteria people usually use to diagnose what they now call as trans kids. At the time, 1980s, Dublin and Ireland, nobody was diagnosing me. They thought of me as an odd kid, an eccentric kid. Yeah, let me off. Do whatever she wants.
Kind of like a very serious tomboy.
A very intense, like tomboy, like nearly every girl says, oh, I was a tomboy, I climbed trees and stuff. And it's like, yeah. I was a whole other level of intensity about it. And I was kind of slightly furious about it. I was kind of slightly furious. Well, not slightly, I was furious that I wasn't a boy, because it was, to me, blindingly obvious I should be a boy. I can still see that in me now. It doesn't stun me that I did come to the conclusion, what the hell am I doing being a girl? Looking back, actually, I was a real internal misogynist, because I used to really disdain girls. And girlish was like the worst insult you could give me, or give anybody, like, girlish. But I was like that for many years. And, for example, in Ireland, you'd have school uniforms, and they brought in a school uniform into the school, and the girls wore dresses and the boys wore trousers, and I wore the trousers. I wore non-school trousers, but trousers, and the jumper, the school jumper. So there was lots of little things that was very odd and eccentric about me, but they let me be. It was very much benign neglect at the time. And they just let me do whatever I wanted without making policies around me, without making a massive amount of attention about me. And ultimately, I went into puberty, you know, at the usual time. And it was really harrowing. It was a horrible experience. Puberty went on and I was lonely and isolated. I really did not want to become a woman. It was the worst thing, you know. Ultimately, I got through. Now, it was really hard. I'm not saying this was easy. It was hard. And I would definitely easily have met the criteria that would now be called a diagnosis of childhood onset gender dysphoria. Horrible experience. But I came through it and ultimately became comfortable in my own skin and ultimately became a mother, which is the thing I'm most proud of and most connected to in my life. So I'm incredibly glad I didn't get the opportunities that children of my ilk would now get. That these days I probably would have been invited to change my pronouns as a child. I would have been invited, certainly brought to doctors for a diagnosis. Puberty blockers would have been certainly spoken about. And had I gone online, I would have heard a lot about puberty blockers. And I would have sailed the seven seas to take puberty blockers as a kid. I would exactly what I wanted. Anything to stop this would have been my attitude. But I didn't have those opportunities and I ended up becoming comfortable, which is arguably the human journey, that you have your challenges and you come to accept the cards you're given in life and work with them. And that's what I did do. Many years later, I became a psychotherapist in my 30s. And I started writing about different issues. You know, I wrote a lot about parenting, a lot about bullying. And one day I noticed that gender was just always in the news. And I noticed an extraordinary story from Canada about Corey Doty and Cyril Doty. And this is a non-binary parent who had fought the Canadian courts for the right to raise their perfectly healthy child as non-binary and not to put the male or female sex marker on their birth cert. And I read that article and went, what? You know, this is a perfectly healthy baby. I didn't know whether it was a girl or a boy, but there was no question that it was, you know, a girl or a boy. And the parent won, the non-binary parent who'd given birth to the child, won. And so you was put on this perfectly healthy baby's birth cert. And there was something about the imposition of the politics of the parent on the child that made me think, I need to kind of add my voice to this extraordinary discussion that's going. What about kids like me who had very strange experiences and came through it? So I wrote an article. I often wrote for the national media, and I wrote an article about my experiences. And from then I was invited to do a film about trans kids. Right. Yeah. And that was 2018. And since then, I've just been immersed in this issue.
There's a huge push these days to get back parental rights, in a sense, yeah. Right? In this country, level politicians have argued that, you know, it's almost like the state should take precedence over parents. I mean, extraordinary stuff. In the whole system, as I've learned, of, you know, the gender-affirming care model, it's the parents that don't agree are somehow viewed as, you know, enemies, yeah. Right? But here, you're sort of flipping this on its head in a way, because you're looking, this parent shouldn't it be the parent's choice? I'm on your side with this, yeah. Right? But what would the rule be here? Well, how does this, right?
Well, it's a very good point you raise. I'd like to just to give a minute to address it. Yeah. When a child is born, immediately it's almost a Venn diagram. There's the child, there's the parents, and there's the state. And if neglect is taking place, and this is where we disagree, you know, the world, where we figure out when is it parenting and when is it time for the state to step in, if you follow me.
Yeah.
That's the kind of issue of the day these days. When is it time? And how much rights does the parent have? And how much rights does the child have? And how much rights does the state have? I think gender has brought about an awareness of this issue, specifically the parental rights versus state rights versus child's rights. It seems to me, I would argue, to push back, that an unnecessary legal document that obfuscates information about the child, a birth cert should arguably be information about the child and not about the parent. Who owns the birth cert, really? Arguably, it should be information about the child. When they were born, who were their parents, whether they were male or female. And anything that the parent wants should be a parent's certificate.
The likelihood that this child will not grow up to become a boy or a girl, a man or a woman, is infinitesimally low. And clearly, you know, the parent is imposing an incredibly large concept. Gosh. I don't know.
Yeah.
Essentially determining the future of this child at a level that's...
And can I say, we've done this already, because we have birth certs. And we also have baptismal certs, if you follow me. In Ireland, let's say if you're Catholic, you have your religious cert as well. That's fine. Go and get, you know, the gender ideology cert, if you like. Go and get your gender cert if that's what the parent wants. But the birth cert should be kind of safeguarded as information, factual information about the child.
You know, imposing on a child from birth the idea that they're somehow non-binary, some people would argue that's abuse. I might be convinced that that's abuse, actually. Right? Because what are you setting a kid up for?
Well, one way or other, it's imposing them a new idea that isn't even 10 years old, and we don't know if it'll last another 10 years. You know that lovely phrase, something like, you know, radical thoughts need radical defences, or, you know what I mean? Like, if you're going to do that, you need some sort of serious weight of evidence.
Right, and this makes me think of this, you know, the standards of care which have been developed around gender by WPATH, as I've learned, you know, fall apart very quickly under the most basic levels of scrutiny. In fact, you know, your organization has done that, right, quite directly.
Yeah, so I founded GenSpect, and what we try to promote in GenSpect is a healthy approach to sex and gender. And WPATH have become the kind of self-identified world authority of transgender rights and transgender healthcare. And they started in 1979, so they're kind of decades ahead of most people who are interested in gender. And they started as a very much a fringe organisation. It was kind of a loose affiliation of trans people, doctors who worked in trans care, trans lawyers, the loose motley crew. And not very many people were interested in it. So they kind of did their own thing quietly. They had their own, you know, conferences, and they brought out what they called was standards of care. Now, standards of care isn't a moniker. You can't just throw standards of care onto a document and say that's a standards of care, although that's what they did. What, you know, standards of care, it has to go through certain criteria.
There has to be an evidence base.
Yeah.
Right.
And there isn't an evidence base. There's no quality long-term evidence base to show that medical transition is the healthier option. It doesn't exist. What there is in those years since 1979 and WPATH formed, is a growing, extraordinary kind of cultural revolution where you can identify as you wish. And when you identify as you wish, doctors, lawyers, schools, hospitals need to fall into your identity. It's an extraordinary kind of
Even as a child, when you're, you know, unlike you perhaps, you're most are incredibly susceptible to these ideas.
Yeah. Right? Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, WPATH say that. They say, you know, it's child-led. It's not child-centred. We used to talk a lot about, I'm a psychotherapist, we talk a lot about child-centred education, child-centred health. But child-led is a whole new frontier where the child is leading the way. So if the child says they want a new name, they get a new name. If they want another new name, they get another new name. If they want a new pronoun, if they want another new pronoun. If they want to make up their own new pronoun that nobody's ever heard of, it's child-led. And they actually say no matter what age. So Diane Ehrensoft is considered a real, you know, representative of WPATH and of gender-affirming healthcare. She would, you know, talk about how a child was opening their onesie and making a skirt of it, and this was a gendered communication at 18 months old, which it's farcical. That's all it is. It's just farcical. Like, the babies.
It's farcical, except that the ramifications are not farcical.
No, they're not.
Right.
Yeah. They've been devastating. So, as I said, WPATH were busy organising themselves in a very culturally driven way so that healthcare became very much buyer, you know, buyer beware, as opposed to first do no harm. And so you go into the doctor and say, I want to be non-binary, I want to remove my breasts, I'm 14 years old and I'm the expert in this room and you're my server. Almost. You just facilitate what I want. You're the doctor, but your job is to affirm everything I say, no matter what age. And this extraordinary kind of dismissal of the years of practice, the responsibility, the role of the doctor to offer guidance, they've turned into, like, you're the shopkeeper, basically, the doctor is. Provide me with my service. And as a result, we will have people who are vulnerable, and they won't benefit from the guidance of somebody who has gone through medical school, who says what you want today might not be good for you. Well, a lot of us want lots of things, and it's not necessarily the best way forward. There are other ways. Could we just go cautiously? And usually if a doctor said that back in the day, you would listen and you would think, well, they have got to this position for a reason. They have years and years of training. But this, it's kind of an individualistic kind of idea of everybody's the expert of themselves. And so even if you're 12 or 14 or 24 and highly vulnerable, and maybe you've had huge mental health issues, it's irrelevant because you're the expert of yourself and you direct your healthcare, even when you're at your most vulnerable. It feels liberating. It's actually very dangerous.
You know, I can't help but think about the fact that you're a psychotherapist, and I've talked to a few people that are, you know, kind of in this space, and who've told me about these radical changes in the profession.
Something extraordinary has happened within psychology, psychotherapy. We've lost our way in many ways. You know, it was very paternalistic, Freudian, you know, that the expert kind of sat behind you and told you what your thoughts were. And that was, I would have my issues with that. You know what I mean? It was disempowering for the person in many ways. But you know the phrase, too far east is west. There is such a thing as a therapeutic process. So if you came to me, we would begin a process, and I would explain that there's going to be ups and downs, and sometimes you're going to be very angry with me, but the idea is we're going to collaborate together, work together, because you haven't come to me for no reason. There's an issue, and the idea is we're going to work together to get beyond it, and it could make you very uncomfortable, but it might. The plan is it will be good for you in the long term.
Right.
This is how we'd work. It's like therapeutic process has segued into therapeutic support, which is a completely different concept. And you hear about the phrase therapeutic support, are you supported? And that is a different idea, because therapeutic support is basically, I'm going to support you in whatever you do. I don't think that's as valuable, because if you came to me and you said, I want to, you know, leave my wife, I want to move to Alaska, I want to start hunting bears, and I think I'm going to live on fish.
Sounds good. But please continue.
We could have a process around that. Yeah. My job as a psychotherapist could think, I'd say there's a lot driving this. It could be work pressure. I'd have my thoughts and I'd say, listen, could we give this time? Could we give this a bit of challenging? You know, let's give this some time and let's go into a process. And the idea would be you'd check out everything. You'd pressure test everything. So if you were to take these moves, you know, you'd feel you've fully tested it and you'd be stronger in yourself. You could apply the same for medical transition. I'm going to leave my wife, leave my children and go to medically transition. I could say, yeah, fine. Could we just look at all this to make sure that when you have dark nights of the soul, which many of us have, you'll think, I thought about this fully and I'm ready to go forth. The problem with therapeutic support would be it seems like a good and loving thing to do. It's certainly very pleasant for everybody involved. But when you have dark nights of the soul in years to come, you'll just think, nobody challenged me. I never second-guessed myself. I never thought about this. I never thought about that. I never thought about it going wrong. It doesn't help them.
Well, it's worse. It's worse than that, because the imprimatur of authority was added to the thing that you're...
It's as if I have given you my blessing, my benediction, and I haven't, because it's within the therapeutic kind of support, you know, diktat, is that I just nod along. And that's why I take such issue with the gender affirmative care approach, which is what WPATH and many gender pro kind of hasty medical transition lobby groups would talk about. They would say gender affirmative is the only way forward for any therapist. And I would say it's anti-therapeutic, it's anti-psychological, because anybody who comes for therapy knows we talk all the ways, we talk, do all the challenges, we explore everything. I'm going to offer some questions that you should think about, but ultimately there's only one person that can take this, and that needs to be you. While if I go, yeah, great idea, yeah, yeah, you'll think you're, you know, solid. And charge off. And that's what's happened with so many young people who've medically transitioned too early. They have found, they thought the therapist was on their side. They thought the therapist was giving them their blessing or their imprimatur. And actually, years to come, they're on their own. They have an awful lot of medical complications. They're finding it very difficult because it's a very heavy burden on the body. They might be infertile. They very often have a lot of sexual functioning problems, difficulty in orgasm. And they're kind of going, where is that therapist? They're gone.
Well, the thing that I've learned over the last however many years, you know, looking at a whole lot of problems in the medical profession, okay, especially public health, is ultimately everything is a cost benefit. Any medical intervention, and that calculation is incredibly important. It's almost like we've forgotten in many cases by having a monomaniacal focus on one thing. One aspect, we forget that there's a cost to that. So if you take the gender affirming, affirmative care model, you know, huge costs to the medicalizations, you know, physical, psychological costs. So, you know, the bar for doing all that should be unbelievably high.
Yeah. Yeah, well, what we're trying to do is put forward the concept of a non-medicalized approach to gender distress. That, like, there's lots of ways to be distressed. There's lots of ways. People have lots of different, you know, as a psychotherapist, I'm never going to be pro-medicalizing. So while the psychiatrist might dispense medication, off they go, they're free to do it. So what Genspect is doing is putting forward a non-medicalized approach to gender distress. It's like all other distress, acting as if it's the most unusual distress in the world is not accurate. There's lots of ways to be distressed in life. There's lots of ways that the human mind goes to and clings on to. So some people might get OCD, some people might get anorexia, some people might get gender dysphoria, and every one of them need a lot of support, might need a therapeutic process, and they would certainly need a way forward. And so we don't subscribe to the idea that it has to be medicalized and that they need to change their whole body. We think that there's ways and means to cope with your distress and to move along. And, you know, a lot of people move out of gender dysphoria. I am one of them. So I am utterly biased, but I also am experienced, if you follow me. I've been there, that I had gender dysphoria. It was horrible. It lasted many, many years, and I'm completely comfortable in my own skin for years now. It never came back.
Well, and you're... Sounds like you're grateful for being able to be a mom.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Yeah, yeah. And I never would have thought it, you know. I was told I was infertile because I had endometriosis when I was 25. And I thought it was kind of funny. I didn't give a damn. Like, I was so dismissive. I just didn't care. And I was 25. 7 years later, I was like this breastfeeding earth mother. I'd completely changed in those years. And those teenagers who so want medical transition, they don't know the fever of wanting a baby that hits people in their 30s. And I wouldn't underestimate it. And these children, because we're only about 10 years into this kind of sharp rise in the numbers of people seeking medical transition, we won't hear about that infertility crisis that's going to hit those for some years now. Because let's say they were 12, 10 years ago, so they're 22 now. They're still a long way from really, really caring. Some of the earlier ones are now starting to even have. I know a detransitioner who had a baby recently. So some of them can get through it and end up with their fertility and have a baby. A lot won't have babies. And they kind of flippantly say surrogacy or adoption. And you're like, that's really tricky and really difficult.
There's a lot of kind of also misleading rhetoric from the people that are supposed to be helping around this. Like that these, you know, puberty blockers are reversible.
I think it's perfectly legitimate for WPATH to say that they're going to promote transgender health care and this is what they are about, and that's their kind of that's their abiding principle. It's not perfectly okay to suggest to young or vulnerable people that taking certain medication doesn't come with huge risks. And puberty blockers would be the big risk. Medicating children to stop their puberty is a radical, very heavy intervention, and all sexual development will stop at that point. And from that day forth, they're out of sync with their peers, so their genitals won't grow, their breasts won't grow, their hair won't grow from that day forth, once you stop the puberty blockers. And so, you know, when you go through puberty and adolescence, every one of us who goes through it, the kind of sexual yearning for a mate begins. So you might get really into love songs, or you might have crushes on people, and you really fall in hard. You're practicing for future adulthood and marriage, and you're going through those motions in quite a deep way. You're going through quite significant developmental. You're also realizing socially, I certainly did, pre-10, a child pre-10, it's me, me, me. I want chocolate, I want toys, I want this friend. And then between 10 and 20, we realize we have to be reciprocal here. We have to have social skills because I want a mate. I want somebody to fall for me, and I want that person to fall for me. And so there's a huge amount of social development happening along with your physical development. If that's just stopped, they've no sexual yearning, they've no crushes, they're still in that childlike state of me, me, me. all their peers are falling for people left, right and centre. They're falling for boys, they're falling for girls, they're having boyfriends or girlfriends. Any child who's confronted with sex before they're sexual, it's icky, it's creepy, it's disgusting. And so it should be, they're pre-sexual. But these kids who've had their puberty blocked, sex is icky and disgusting for them, while all their friends are fancying people. So they're completely out of sync. They're being brought out of the tribe. They're suspended in a glass bubble for all those years while everybody else is developing sexually. And then when they hit 18, they release the puberty blocker and give them cross-sex hormones. And that means they become the opposite sex. It is an extraordinary intervention. And so the little boy's penis will have stayed prepubescent. And so of course he'll feel completely out of sync with all the boys who are developing. The same with the girls' genitals and stuff. It's such a shocking intervention. People don't like anybody speaking about it because it feels really inappropriate to talk about children and anything to do with their genitals, which it is. But it's more inappropriate to intervene and interfere than to talk about it. And we need to talk about it because puberty blockers is interfering with their sexual development and their physical healthy development. And they're interfering with it with a body of evidence that does not stand up to scrutiny. What they have is very, very, very shoddy literature of a small number of children, and one of the children of a small group of children that were researched. One of them died as a result of cross-sex hormones. It started, let's say, in the Netherlands. This clinic in the Netherlands decided to give children puberty blockers as a way to say, well, they're not happy when they transition as adults. So maybe if we transition them as children, it'll have better results. Radical, extraordinary, very heavy experiment, but they decided to do it. They didn't have a control group. So they didn't have a group of children that they didn't give these interventions to follow. They just took these, and they took a very healthy group of children. There was, out of about 150, they took about 70, and they followed these 70 children, and they gave them puberty blockers. They stopped their puberty. And of that 70, 15 backed out of the study. And of those 15, some of them developed diabetes, heart complaints, all sorts of issues that you'd want to say, what happened there? And then of the 55 that were left, they went on, they continued their study, and one of those children died when they were getting cross-sex surgery. And so I would say one out of 70 died, end of study, end of research. This doesn't work. It's you know, the dangers are way too high. The risks are way too high. These are children we're working with. This is inappropriate. But they didn't think that. They thought it was a great success. And doctors came over from America to the Netherlands in 2008 and brought back this highly experimental treatment and started to operate in the US. And from there, if you track it, the gender identity clinics grew exponentially. There was extraordinary growth in gender identity clinics. And this offer of kids like me who were having a horrible puberty, would you like to stop your puberty? And they said, yeah, sure.
If I understand it, in that study, they also excluded kids that had serious psychiatric comorbidities in the first place. So never mind that it was a failed study, but in our current scenario, most of these kids actually have serious issues that have nothing to do with the dysphoria.
Yeah,
right?
You make a very good point. They had very strict criteria for these 70 kids, and one of them was they had to have childhood onset, like me, from a very young child. And they also had to be mentally very robust, other than their gender issues. I'll just go back to that in a second. And these days, the vast majority of children who are going to these clinics did not have childhood onset. They didn't have it at 3 or 4 or 5 or 6. They had it later. Usually it was puberty onset. And they're a completely different type of child. They weren't in the study. They're very loud in what they want.
One of the things that I've sort of observed, and this has come up in multiple interviews on different topics, I might add, not necessarily gender, the infantilization of our society,
yeah,
in general. Of course, there's this huge surge in gender nonconforming kids. I think there's compelling arguments that a lot of this is a kind of a social phenomenon, social contagion, this kind of thing, especially among the girls. This is all in the context of a broader picture where somehow it's almost like we want to slow the process to adulthood or something. Do you see something like this at all?
Yeah, I do. I've studied it in great detail. And it's kind of tragic because we've shortened childhood. So, like, you know, childhood is shorter, but adolescence has been elongated until the mid-20s, if you follow me. It's adolescence that is in many ways. Once they get their smartphone, their days of freedom, you know, childhood and self-consciousness is kind of gone. But they're infantilized in adolescence. And some writers have written very well about it, you know, Jean Twenge and John Haight and stuff. They've really written very well about this infantilization of these adolescents. So they're in this prolonged adolescence where everything is mommy and daddy's fault, but the children don't really take a responsibility. For example, getting a job now as an adolescent is much harder than it would have been in other generations. They've learned to kind of be quite babyish in their adolescence. They don't go out as much as they used to in other generations. They don't meet their friends as much. They're not breaking away from their family very much. When they go to college, the amount of expectation on parents when kids go to college these days, it's unbelievable. So they're in this prolonged adolescence until deep into their 20s. And it's sadly that their childhood was kind of taken from them quite early. It's their adolescence. It's the worst of all worlds. Who wants that?
I mean, that's interesting, but how does that, the gender phenomenon fit into this?
It very much fits into it because the adolescent has been brought up by society, not just by their parents, but by an entire culture to say, if you're not happy, look to the nearest adult to make you happy. I wrote a book called Bullyproof Kids in 2017, and I realised we've got to watch it with kids immediately saying, bullying, adult, come in. We have to kind of build a little bit of resilience, so there has to be step two, go to the adult. Step one, see if you can handle this tricky situation. And let's bring in the concept of tricky people rather than bullies. Some people are tricky, some people are bullies, you know what I mean? Put a buffer between straight to the bullying and straight to the adults so that we all, it's a gift for life, learn to deal with tricky people and learn to deal with difficult people. But that has been wiped away in many cultures, and these days the emphasis is look to the adult. Adult, help me. I'm not happy. Help me. And so when the child is going through the storms and stresses of adolescence, when the child is going through puberty and is feeling insecure and all the things that make you the adult you'll one day be, they think, I'm not happy, something must be wrong. And so they go to their parents, they go to the online, they go looking for a solution rather than being told, honestly, life is difficult. You're going to feel like this many, many times until you die. It's still beautiful, but it can be really difficult.
There's this decrease in resiliency, you're arguing, because of, you know, how we've been raising our kids and educating them and so forth. But so a big part of this, let's call it the woke ideology complex, including gender ideology, a lot of it involves bullying people into agreeing to things that don't make a ton of sense to most people. People are much less resilient in, you know, Western societies that have kind of adopted these types of approaches to actually deal with that, because they've always had to go to the adult. There's no adult.
Resilience as a word has become one of those kind of problematic words, because it's like we're reducing the person's pain by asking them to build resilience. But it's actually a fundamental need for the human to acquire if they are to kind of manage to have some well-being in life. Now, you could skip it and you could not learn resilience, but you will end up deeply unhappy.
Suffering is needed in the process.
Sadly, I think life is really difficult. The fact is there's homelessness, there's dreadful, dreadful mental health problems in all our families. And so that we have to learn to live with the tragedy of life, that children will run across the road today and get knocked over by a car. Tragedies happen. And we still have to kind of manage our lives and be happy if we can and fall in love and nature is beautiful. That is the only life we're being offered. It's a tragic life, but it's a beautiful life. I find again and again and again, I work as a psychotherapist very often with teenagers, I'm teaching them that their feelings are absolutely justifiable And also very common. It's very common to feel very lonely. It's very common to feel like you utterly screwed up and you're a clown and you shouldn't have done it. And you still can manage to be happy, having all these ups and downs in our mind.
And you shouldn't just say, oh, that's their fault.
And you shouldn't just think, where's my diagnosis? I felt really lost and alienated and something's wrong and I need to be fixed. Something's wrong with the machine. And it's like, no, that's the human condition you're dealing with. That's the human. You can get a diagnosis. They're out there. But it is the human condition that none of us have mastered.
You know, Stella, I could talk to you for hours. I'm sure you're a fantastic psychotherapist.
Just from encountering
this conversation. As we finish up, when kids say they're trans, just tell me what will people learn from the book?
Myself and Sasha Ayad and Lisa Marciano wrote this book. We're all three of us are therapists. Sasha and Lisa are based in the US and I'm based in Ireland. And we met each other over online because so many parents were coming to us in devastation over their children identifying as trans. And all we were offering was how to help parents help their children. Because so many of these children were really vulnerable, very often autistic, very often neurodivergent in some way, vulnerable, socially awkward kids. And they had parents who were often vulnerable and socially awkward themselves. And they were absolutely isolated by a culture that told them, fast track to them, to the medicalization, this will help them. It's a very beguiling, alluring thought, which is you are lost, you hate your body, you hate yourself, and you're 14, and you can be a different person with a different name and a different pronoun and a different body, and nobody will ever be able to refer to the old you. And so these kids fall for it, and they think, I want to be that person. And we wrote the book, When Kids Say They're Trans, to support parents who say, fast track medicalization is not for my kid. I just want to explore, how can I help my kid just to slow down and explore other options, such as a non-medicalized approach. And then when they're adults, they can do whatever they want. But at least I, as a parent, have protected them from something that they won't be able to come back from if they have a mastectomy or something. So that's why we wrote it.
Well, Stella O'Malley, it's such a pleasure to have had you on.
Thank you very much.
Thank you all for joining Stella O'Malley and me on this episode of American Thought Leaders. I'm your host, Yanya Kelek.